sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Cardcast, Dwarfcast, episode 12. Today we will discuss the shared book series called Wild Cards, a look at how superheroes and villains might affect popular culture and our existing world. I'd like to introduce you to Fanboy. Now that's spelled P-H-A-N-N, and not to be confused with the copyrighted movie title Fanboy about Star Wars nerds. Fanboy is Jim Caswell, executive producer, comic book fan, and Star Wars nerd.
And it's my duty to introduce the mild-mannered millionaire playboy, Doug Zeitlin, better known as the Caped Crustacean.
I had that looked at, and the salve worked fine.
Wild Cards is a 18-book series edited by George R.R. Martin and created by him and basically his gaming buddies, who also happen to be big-name authors in the science fiction industry.
Essentially, are you saying that they took these, like, role-playing sessions and they made them into books?
The way I understand it, that's exactly what happened. These very creative, very character-driven writers sat around, enjoyed each other's company while gaming, and decided, hey, the stuff that we've created here is good enough that we could put it together into a book and sell it. And now, 18 books later, I think that they were proven correct. It was good enough. The game in question was called Superworld, and it was game mastered by George R.R. Martin himself.
So, basically, George R.R. Martin likes to control all of his friends, and he likes to edit their books, too.
See, I'm not seeing a problem with this, but then again, I'm a game master, I enjoy co-running a world, and I enjoy editing the work that my friends write. Never mind. Yes, I guess I really am. Dun-dun-dun! Fanboy! Does that make you my sidekick geek?
No, that would be our monkey. See, I think it works the other way. I'm super dork. You're my sidekick fanboy.
Whatever works in your little universe is fine by me. But shall we get off of the topic of how geeky we are and illustrate how geeky we are by talking about superhero books?
Sure, why not? Although there are currently 18 books in the series, it hasn't been a continual run and it hasn't been all with one publisher either.
The series started out in 1987 with Bantam Books, and it stayed with that publishing company through 12 novels over 6 years. They produced 3 in that first year. I guess that's the great thing about contracts.
That was the year that I found them, was 1987. Without getting into the nitty-gritty of the books, I actually started reading them when Book 4 came out, which is my least favorite of the books, but at least I read them in order.
And, again, you were the one that introduced me to this series. Knowing how big of a comic book geek I was, you said, here, you've got to read these. I read the first 2 and then proceeded to go on out, buy the first 2, and pick up the rest of them to make sure that I had a complete set.
I guess one of the things that was disappointing about reading Book 12 is it really came to a nice conclusion, and it was kind of like, this is the end of the series. We've done 12 books in 6 years. We're tired of this. Thank you very much for being our audience. It was kind of a disappointment.
It did have a very final feel to it. Several of the lead characters were retired at that point. All of the major storylines were wrapped up. It was a finale. Little did we know that later on that same year, in 1993, the book would switch publishers and start up a quote-unquote new cycle.
And remember, this is pre-internet, so there's no way for us to go on Wikipedia and look up and see what the new book is coming out. There's no George R.R. Martin website. There's no Wildcards website. This is back in the days where Yahoo didn't exist. If you wanted to go onto somebody's website, you had to type in 612.998.201 to find your website.
And more than likely, it was a governmental website.
Or college. The infancy of the internet really did exist. But it wasn't like we have today, with Google and broadband and WWW2 existing.
The news cycle ran through the next 5 novels, and it was pretty clear that the writers were slowing down. The rest of their careers were picking up some.
Well, even so, in retrospect, it's called the news cycle, but really it was a trilogy. 3 very tightly related books introducing new characters and new concepts into this universe. And then 2 standalone books that followed it.
Bane Publishers had a contract for 3 books, Card Sharks, Marked Cards, and Black Trump. Like Doug said, it was a trilogy. It came out over the process of 3 years. And it was a fairly self-contained series.
It was absolutely self-contained. It dealt with some of the early characters, it created some of its own characters, and it left enough story plots that, had there been another trilogy afterwards, could have gone on with more stories.
Instead, what happened was that they took a 7-year hiatus before they brought out Deuces Down. Deuces Down was a standalone solo book that dealt with minor characters or new characters whose abilities were considered less than the main characters. Another 4 years passed, and they brought out Death Draws 5, another standalone novel. It was written by just one author for a change, as opposed to a conglomeration, and it was written by John J. Miller. And it serves as a decent springboard between the old generation wild cards and the new generation characters that are being introduced with the brand new book.
Without knowing exactly what was in George R. R. Martin's mind, I believe that that was his intention. Where those storylines, which I said were still out there after the last trilogy, seemed like he was just trying to wrap those up, introduce some new characters, and say, okay, this story is done, we're ready to start a new story. Coincidentally, that's what they did at book 12 also.
At that point, the series switched publishers yet again, now moving to Tor Books. And Tor Books will be continuing on the series for at least the next 3 novels. The first of which is called Inside Straight, which is the book that we will be reviewing today.
One of those circumstances were, does art imitate life? Or does life imitate art? So all these characters start out as role-playing characters, and then in 1989, these characters were brought over to a game system.
A very popular gaming system at the time called GURPS.
I'm sure everybody who listens to this knows what that means, but stands for Generic Universal Role-Playing System.
Yeah, everybody who listens knows that, right, people? I didn't even know that.
I said, super dork.
1989 was in between the 5th and 6th book of the series. It was really hitting its stride at this point in time, and GURPS saw an opportunity and they jumped all over it. They produced a rule system book for it, they produced supplementals, put out a lot of material for it, thus bringing it back to its original home at the tabletop.
And now that the novels are coming back, so is the role-playing system.
In 2008, Mutants and Masterminds is going to be releasing a wildcard supplemental to their gaming system, once again putting the Wild Cards universe into gamers' hands. It will be making its debut at Origins in 2008.
If books and role-playing aren't enough for the average fan, of course it's cross-media.
Around the same time that GURPS produced their role-playing game, Epic and Marvel Comics teamed up to produce a 4-issue limited series of Wild Cards.
It actually had spectacular art. It was in what they then called the prestige format.
Higher quality paper, painted artwork, a harder cover to it. Also, you could pay a higher price for it.
Of course.
But it was worth it at that time because you got a prestige format comic for like $1.99, whereas you pay more than that for your standard comic book these days.
Listeners who are not old enough to remember the days when comics themselves were printed on newsprint and cost under $1. When you paid that extra, you were actually getting something of higher quality. And again, now in 2008, comic books are coming out. History is repeating itself.
The Dabble Brothers, which are partnering with Marvel Comics, is putting out a 6-issue limited series that will be coming out in April. Of course, going on Amazon, you can order the graphic novel, which will be a combination of the 6 issues, and it's coming out in December, and pay $20 or so for it.
All right. What is Wild Cards? It is a shared superhero universe with a twist. You have Marvel Comics, where the major twist on superheroes is the X-Factor. DC Comics, once upon a time, capped on the metagene. I don't know if that actually still exists in their universe or not.
Yeah, but they've downplayed a lot.
So here's the twist. There's a civilization on an extrasolar planet. They develop a super soldier formula, but it's untested. Turns out that humans and these people on a planet called Takus are virtually genetically identical. So they're going to use the super soldier formula, which actually is in the form of a genetic virus, They're going to bring it to Earth, test it on an isolated population, and see what happens.
These scientists, not knowing what it was going to do to the population, decide to test it on New York City. The effects is that 99 out of 100 people exposed to the virus pulls the Black Queen. The Black Queen kills you instantly, horrifically, and graphically.
Graphically and horrifically are understatements. You'll have to read the first book to really get a true sense of just how incredibly horrible this is.
This is a very good place to point out that these are not meant for children. They are very graphic. They are very adult.
I would argue that actually only the first 12 are. So you've got a 1% survival ratio, which is not necessarily a good thing. Of this surviving 1%, 99 pull a Joker. Now, a Joker is essentially a horrific deformity. And there's nothing in the real world that compares. It's not like being born with one arm. It'd be more like being born with one arm that is an elephant's trunk. And that would be a mild case of Jokerism. People develop into literally human-sized cockroaches. Or there's a particular character called Father Squid who essentially has a man's body and a deformed head with squid. Like, think Davy Jones from Pirates of the Caribbean. And it gets worse. Anything that your imagination can come up with, that's what a Joker can be.
The 0.01% that doesn't die and doesn't get transformed horrifically become what are known as aces. Aces are what you would consider to be your standard superhero fare, pseudo-god type people. They have super strength, they have invulnerability, they have the power of flight, things of that nature.
Now, if already this wasn't random enough that you can die, become deformed, or become a superhuman, there's a psychological limitation. For the majority of people who would be called aces, there is some sort of a limitation on how they can use their powers. There's a particular character who has the ability to teleport other people. The only way he can do this is to make his fist into a gun shape and pop them out of existence. There is another character, the strongest telekinetic on the planet, but he can only use his powers when he's unseen. Croyd Crenson, his superhero name is the Sleeper, because his power is the very definition of the wild card virus. When he sleeps, the virus reinfects him, and he has a chance of becoming a Joker, becoming a Joker ace, becoming an ace, becoming a deuce. So because he knows that his sleep changes him, when he gets powers that he likes, he stays awake as long as he possibly can, using drugs and things like that. There is an extremely strong magician. Essentially, he has unlimited power, but in order to charge his batteries, he must practice tantric sex.
Again, not necessarily reading material for the kiddies.
As we said, in these books, the stuff is extremely graphic. I guess I'll give you a light example to say that as part of the practice of this tantric sex, the character must block his semen flow and keep it internalized because that's the key to him obtaining his powers. And it very graphically describes how he does this.
So you get the idea. They all have powers. They all have limitations. Fairly standard fare as far as your stereotypical superheroes go. There are occasionally times where things get mixed together. For example, a Joker who also has ace abilities, so they're considered an ace. A good example of this is the character of Peregrine, who grew a pair of wings, but her ace ability actually allows her to fly. Without the ability to fly, she's just a Joker because she has these large wings growing out of her back.
I think that's a good example also in the current book. There's a musician called Drummer Boy. Essentially, he is a Joker. He has six arms. His torso is shaped in such a way that when he pounds on his own chest, it makes various drum-like sounds. But he's 7 foot tall. He's incredibly strong. So in addition to being a deformed Joker, he's a very strong ace.
On the flip side, you also have some aces whose abilities are considered minor enough that they're really not considered that beneficial, and they're often referred to as deuces, as in deuces down.
Again, this is a genetic virus, so one of the secondary story plots is people who have been exposed to the virus and have lived, their children have a very high likelihood of also having the active virus, which means the child has a 99% chance of dying a horrific death, that 1% chance of becoming hideously deformed, and that 1/100th of a percent chance of getting powers.
So now you have an idea of how this virus works. It is hereditary. It was airborne. It was primarily released in the New York area, but as wind currents are known to do, it did get spread throughout the rest of the world. Its mortality rate just wasn't as high across the rest of the globe.
I kind of gather that, much like the Ebola virus, which kind of flares up and disappears and flares up and disappears, that the wild card virus will flare up and kind of die down again, and then it'll flare up and kind of die down again. So there's pockets of resurgence.
So Tachius brings this virus to Earth to release it. This is in 1945. It's after World War II has ended, and a pilot who has returned from the war is heading out to go see the Al Jolson story, a new released film, when he comes across this virus in the form of a bomb, does everything in his power to stop it, and fails. How's that for a way to start out your story? We're going to create this hero, and his only act of heroics, he fails, and thousands upon thousands of people die.
And actually, his act of heroism makes him that first superhero. He has no powers at all, but he's considered the first superhero, called Jet Boy. Technically, the biological name or whatever for the virus is Xenovirus Tachus A. But of course, as we've shown, it has multiple effects, hence its wild card nature and how it gets the nickname wild cards that all the books are named for. Throughout almost the whole first two books, there's a lot of setup. And what's happening is it's showing how now we have the real universe. Theoretically, everything that's happening in our real world has also happened or is happening within the wild card universe. But how people with superpowers would affect popular culture, modern events. Things like Kennedy ends up not being assassinated. When the American hostages were being held in Iran, instead of sending Delta Force, they sent a group of aces. Some are little tiny twists, some are major story changes.
So you have Jet Boy, who performs a truly heroic act and fails. The next big character introduced is a citizen of Tachus named Dr. Tachian. He has been sent to study the results of this virus and is horrified by the results. He then sets out to try to make amends for what his people have done to Earth.
This character from Tachus is not actually named Dr. Tachian. His name apparently is unpronounceable in English. And Dr. Tachian is this very flamboyant, very outgoing personality. He wears very garish clothing. He's got hair, which is apparently, whereas it's not physically copper, the material, it's physically metallic and shiny like copper. And this character helps tie many of the first 12 books together. He's a character that weaves in and out of different stories and is used by multiple authors to advance storylines.
Out of the entire original 12-book series, he is the primary character involved. He has the most face time within all of the books.
One of the interesting things about the series is because it's a shared universe and many authors, that there are other characters who appear in multiple books and multiple stories, but they're all copyrighted and owned by their individual writer.
In these books, you have some villains, and you have a few truly good guys. But many, many, many of the characters fall more into the gray area. They're not villainous. They're not exactly heroic either by the standard definition.
I think this is one of the things that really makes this story stand out. When you look at the classic comic series, such as Superman or Captain America, here are people, classically, now I realize things change over the years, they are the good guy. They will always do what's right. They will always do what's best. And the villains in their comic books are the bad guys. They're not somebody who meant to do right and did it the wrong way. They are clearly villains. And these people do exist in the wild card universe. But much like real life, most of the characters fall somewhere in the middle. They really are looking out for themselves. If that means they participate on the side of justice, they will do that. if that means they can become physically intangible and become a cat burglar because they can walk through walls and put their hands in safes, they're going to do that.
But that cat burglar isn't necessarily a bad guy because they have their own moral stance on things and will occasionally do the right thing because they're capable of helping out as well. So it deals a lot in the gray area. Dr. Tachkin himself is very gray. He is trying to help out humanity and recover from this disease that his people has brought. But at the same time, he has no problem in going on out and having extramarital affairs, becoming a drunk.
He is a stereotypical socialite. He goes out and parties. He likes to be part of the jet set. And when it comes to his medical side, when he's in the office, when he's dealing with the wildcard virus, he's a very professional, very educated, very good person. Take him out of that environment, and he is 180 degrees different.
But, again, much like real life, when people make these types of decisions, it often will turn around and bite them in the butt later on. As Doug mentioned earlier, books 1 and 2 were pretty much a setup of the world. Books 3 through 12 dealt with a second generation of wild cards. These were the people who have had it since childhood or since birth, rather than getting hit with the virus in the first wave. The new cycle continued dealing with that second generation, intermixing a little bit of third generation into it. And now the new set of books coming out from Tor deal primarily with the third generation of wildcard victims.
The one thing that's really stayed consistent between all the series and all of the authors is that because it's supposed to be a parallel Earth to ours, they've all dealt with issues of pop culture, of current politics, of existing real-world events that people will be familiar with.
When George Bush Sr. was in the White House in our world promising no new taxes, President George Bush was in the Wild Cards universe, promising no new exotic taxes. Exotic being the politically correct term for wild card victims.
Yes, he was lying to his people also. We'll still share a little bit about stuff that's happened in the old series, because it's hard to relate the new one without talking about the old one. But
two things before we get started on that. Number one, you don't have to read the previous 17 books in order to read the new book, but once you've read the new book, you will probably want to go back and read the previous 17 books.
I completely agree with this. As this book itself is literally for the next generation of heroes, it's a really good jumping on point, and I think that the book was good enough that it was a really enjoyable experience that you'll go back and read the old stuff. It will have a different feel to it, though.
Item number two. If you have not read this book and you already know that you want to read the book, this is going to be the spoiler zone. At this point, if you don't want any spoilers, jump to the last minute and a half of the broadcast and pick things up when we talk about our current tort projects. But fair warning.
If you don't like spoilers, this is the time to fast forward.
Exactly. The new book in the series is called Inside Straight.
In Inside Straight, the pop cultural reference starts with a television show called American Hero, which is exactly what it sounds like. It is the American Idol of our parallel universe in the Wild Cards.
Actually, I think a better representation of it would even be that it is the worst of all reality programming, all mixed together into one show. You've got the teams competing against each other. You've got the popularity vote involved. You've got casting for personality rather than talent.
Well, I stand corrected by the person who actually watches reality television programming.
Just Survivor. Hi, I'm Jim. I'm a Survivor addict.
In fairness, I have watched Who Wants to Be a Superhero, the two seasons it's been on Sci-Fi Channel. Found it a fairly enjoyable show. So not only is this the worst of all of the reality shows, I mean, it really makes fun of reality shows. It's what Who Wants to Be a Superhero would be if people actually had superpowers.
And that's a very good thing to point out, because Who Wants to Be a Superhero is, in my opinion, one of the best quote-unquote reality shows out there, because it holds to high moral values and things of that nature. And you're right. If real people had real superpowers, it wouldn't be called American Hero. It would be called Who Wants to Be a Superhero.
And again, kind of the difference between American Hero and Who Wants to Be a Superhero is Who Wants to Be a Superhero is looking for heroes that wear the white hats. It's not looking for the gray characters. In the book version, American Hero, they're actually looking for the gray characters because it makes for good television. They want people who are going to throw spice into the pot. They want people who America's going to go, oh, I can't believe they said that.
One character is cast specifically so that they can bleep out every other word that he says.
And I know it's a work of fiction, but you can so see this on Survivor or any reality show. They cast redneck hillbillies with minority people to watch them clash.
Hoping that they'll clash.
The book points it out very poignantly. That being said, and again, spoiler, the American Hero show, which really dominates a half to two-thirds of this book, is a MacGuffin. It is the introduction to the characters, you learn their personalities, and you learn their powers, but it's not important to the story.
I will actually argue with that point just for one simple reason, and that's because they use this MacGuffin to accentuate the fact that some of these people are here to become famous. They're here to use their powers to get FaceTime. But then there are other people who are there because they want to become a hero. They have the heart of a hero. They have the desire to help other people. And it's very good use of a public medium to start drawing the lines between those two types of characters.
That being said, they did a good job with that. However, using this American Hero TV show as the MacGuffin, I think, is one of the biggest weaknesses of the piece. It's so much fluff that there were really only two stories in that whole storyline, which I thought were important. And actually, both involved the character Stuntman. Number one, showing that some of the people were there because they believed in heroism. Some of the people being there because they wanted fame, and some of the people being there because they wanted money. The first story with Stuntman does a really good job of establishing who's there to do what, why people are on this television show. The final story with Stuntman does a really good job of dealing with the consequences of actually winning and realizing that winning the show American Hero wasn't necessarily winning the point of the show. That was really all you really needed were those two Stuntman stories.
Yeah, but the other stories do a good job of introducing other characters like Hive and Bubbles and Curveball and some of the characters that are going to be used later on. It gives a good opportunity to delve into what motivates these characters and showing growth.
It does show growth, but it doesn't give the depth that these characters could have had. We know this character, Jonathan Hive, wants to be a reporter. But we don't know anything of his background. We don't know what makes him tick, why he does this. Again, the fact that he wants to be a reporter is a MacGuffin to get him into Egypt, where the primary story happens. So if we knew why it was so important to him to be a reporter, it would make the fact that he did travel across the world to a continent where people were dying and he was risking his own life, it would have made it more poignant.
I felt as though they did a wonderful job of capturing the competitive reality series mindset. The people who, much like on Survivor, when you have people who you would consider to be a physical threat later on who exemplify the idea of what the show is about, whether it be somebody who can survive in nature or someone who would make for an excellent superhero, if enough people see you as being very good at that one thing, that makes you a target, that makes you lose the game because they consider you to be a threat. Most of the people who are truly good at surviving are often the first people to get voted off of the island.
I agree with you. They did an extremely good job of picturing that survivor mentality. The whole idea is it's not about being the best survivor. It's about playing the politics to keep you as the last member. From the first season of Survivor, the only one I've actually watched, Rudy, the third player from the last, being an ex-Army Ranger and having real Survivor experience, would have been the best, most likely character to win, but Rudy didn't play the politics. That being said, he actually lost for a stupid mistake anyways, but
using that same example, you have Richard Hatch, who is a businessman who has lied, cheated, stole, and backstabbed his way to the top. You have Kelly, who is a professional whitewater rapid tour guide who has made it to the final round because she has won every single physical challenge for the past 6 rounds. And people were mad at her because she won the challenges and ruined their plans, and therefore they gave the money to Richard Hatch. The logic there still to this day dumbfounds me.
Richard Hatch actually goes to your point of showing it's not important that you're the physical survivor or you're the physical hero, but that you played the political game. And this book, Inside Straight, does a great job of showing how even people with superpowers can play that political game. It eats up way too much of a book which talks about some really important social issues. So it has on the one side the pop culture reference eating the whole book up, and on the other side there's really important social political issues that the last third of the book deals with that are given essentially lip service.
And in this day and age, this differs from reality how?
Because this is a book, and George R. R. Martin had control over it, not like it's the news and the advertisers had control.
I find this part of the discussion very funny because even within the book, they hit upon the fact that in the middle of this great big turmoil that several of the characters find themselves in, the only thing that America cares about is the American hero game going on back home. So the flaw that you're finding in the book is the exact flaw that the characters have to deal with and the exact flaw that we deal with in society on a daily basis. People care more about what Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt are doing than the fact that people are dying left and right in the Sudan.
Which is actually paid lip service to in the book! But I agree with your point. It's totally ironic that one of the things the book is doing is being guilty of something that it complains about. If you want to develop the characters, it's fine. There's a character in there called Earthwitch who thinks all that she can do is dig holes. But really, she has complete mastery of the ground. She'd be what maybe a comic book fan would call an elemental. Anything that touches the ground or the earth, she can control. She can make valleys, she can make mountains. Really has this full control, but doesn't realize it when she becomes a contestant on the show. It's not until she's talking with her fellow heroes that she figures out that she really is much more powerful than she thinks. That whole story could have been developed with her brother. I mean, there's a whole earlier storyline. It's her brother that gets her to go on the American Hero show. It's the brother that influences her. They could have done a lot more background with her and have her develop her powers and be like, gee, you're right. I am very powerful. Maybe I should go on the show. I mean, it didn't have to be during the show that you develop her character. It could have been prior to the show.
Well, this is going to be one of those points where we will have to agree to disagree, because I thought that they used that situation very well, and I appreciated it.
I agree. This is America. You have the right to be wrong.
Another aspect of this book, which, again, gets its roots in the American hero storyline, but then is quickly carried over into the rest of the story, is that of John Fortune. John Fortune is the son of Fortunato and Peregrine. These two characters came together in a power-up session for Fortunato before they went off to battle the astronomer in one of the previous books. This character is also the focus of Death Draws Five, which was the previous book. He's that bridging aspect that we talked about earlier.
Without spoiling the last book, you know that the character survives. However, he is a child of two parents, both with the wild card. So, of course, he draws the wild card. I encourage you to read Death Draws 5 to see exactly what happens, because it's not what you think.
Between the use of John Fortune and a group of characters called the Living Gods, who are introduced in the fourth book, yes, that is the fourth book, the aforementioned worst book of the series, but the fact that they're able to bring these characters back and make good use of them is a credit to the writers.
I agree with that.
John Fortune and the Living Gods are dealing with a situation in Egypt revolving around repercussions from an assassination that takes place at the very beginning of the book.
As we said, there's two things the Wildcard series does really well. One of them is dealing with pop culture and how superheroes would affect pop culture. The second aspect that it does very well is dealing with modern social political topics, and that's the meat and bones of the story, which to me there was too little of in Inside Straight. although they're dealing with the ramifications of the assassination. It's a MacGuffin, it's a turning point. It's not the important part of the story. The important part is the ramifications. The living gods are people from the Middle East who have been infected by the wildcard virus. They are effectively jokers or joker races, and they've taken the form of the Egyptian gods. This has created a revival of the old Egyptian religion revolving around the gods, who say these people have been infected by the wildcard virus, who have the shape and form of the Egyptian gods, are actually physical living embodiments of these original gods. And they're quite literally, they're worshipped, and this infuriates the Muslim world. The Muslims, having previously been united under a caliph, essentially the caliph, believes it was one of these jokers that assassinated his predecessor. And he's using this as an excuse for genocide. He's going to kill all of the new gods and all of their followers.
They want to wipe the Joker and Ace population out of the Middle East.
This is part of the social-political nature of the books, whether you consider this similar to what's going on in Darfur or anywhere else. There's really bad people out there. It does a really good job of showing what could happen. In the previous 12 novels, we've had these really incredibly major villains. We've had this guy named the Astronomer, who essentially, he's the bad guy to Fortunato's good guy. He has the tantric sex magic, although it's not sex, it's actually mutilation that he gets his powers from. There's the Swarm, the aliens from outer space. They are literally going to destroy the planet. These people called Jumpers, who literally take over people's bodies by buggery. We have these really, really nasty, world-shattering villains who literally takes all the white hats and all of the people that are gray to get together and work to defeat. We don't have that in this book. And that's something that's kind of missing. I say that because that's actually going to be one of my complaints with the existing storyline. The Muslim population is at least a quarter of this world. So we're talking 1.5 billion people. I find it hard to believe that the caliph could only find 2 aces, the Bahir and the Righteous Jinn, to form his side of the army and commit genocide. I understand that it's only 0.1% of the population that become aces, but 100% of the Muslim population is not 2.
Without going into a large religious debate and dealing with the concepts of right and wrong within a religious environment, I have less of a problem in believing that aspect of things, just because if there were any aces who received their powers and didn't side with the extreme, let's wipe out everyone that doesn't agree with us mentality, they would have either defected or have been killed off themselves. So the idea that there were only 2 within this...
out of 1.5 billion?
You're thinking of the entire Muslim nation.
That's what the caliph is. He's the leader of the Muslim nation.
Technically, yes, but they don't always agree with what the leader is doing. For example, when 9/11 happened, you had most of the Muslim nation here in the United States condemning what their Muslim brothers had done. They didn't agree with what had happened. There being people who don't agree with the idea of committing genocide and therefore leaving, I don't have a problem with.
Okay. The story does a very good job of distinguishing between this man who is the caliph is insane, and it's his doing, and it's not the Muslim world. It makes it perfectly clear that being Muslim is not the same thing as being a terrorist. It is definitely not prejudicial that way. The second is on your comment on 9/11. Here you've got Osama bin Laden. It's one man. He's not a caliph. He's not the leader of 1.5 billion people. He can find 19 people to commit suicide on airplanes. I would believe that the leader of 1.5 billion people could find more than 2.
It's a point that's hard for me to argue because I don't have a frame of reference, because it's a completely different mindset than anything that I could possibly understand.
From my point of view, it's not believable that he could only find 2 aces. Whereas the obviously small minority of jokers could have 7 or 9 from one reality television show come over and help them. And that's actually another point that bugs me about the book, is how come the only aces that came to help in the situation were these reality show contestants? And I know this is a springboard for the next generation, but where were all these heroes who fought the Astronomer, who fought the Bloat, who fought the Swarm? Why aren't they there protecting the jokers? And even more to the point of helping Jokers, this series has clearly defined Vietnam as a nation of Jokers for Jokers, and natural people are not welcome there. Where's their army? Captain Tripp, as the president of that nation, I fully believe he'd have had battalion after battalion going over there and saying, you know what, these are my people, I'm going to protect them.
I will say that they did cover that to my satisfaction, simply because the only press that they were getting for the majority of this genocide was through Jonathan Hive's blog, which most journalists would not consider to even be considered a true news source. The war between the Living God's army and the Egyptian army really only lasted about 3 days, which, if it wasn't for the fact that Jonathan Hive had these connections that were built up through American Hero, even they probably wouldn't have known about it, but they were reading his blog because he was a acquaintance of theirs.
As far as America goes, I actually would concede that point. I agree with you. Just watching real America, people don't know what's going on in international news. I still think that Captain Tripp should be watching out for his people. I would love to go into that story for our listeners. Captain Tripp is just a marvelous character. He's been around probably since the beginning. He's a guy like the sleeper whose powers change from sleep to sleep. Captain Tripp uses pharmaceuticals, and different pharmaceuticals give him different powers. You gotta read it. But he went to Vietnam, and essentially he has made this a safe nation for Jokers.
As far as Captain Tripp goes, I will again point to Real World. In dealing with things like the United Nations and keeping it from becoming a world war instantaneously and turning yourself into the bad guy, there are certain protocols that have to be taken before you can send an army into a foreign land.
That's assuming that Captain Tripp has grown enough to follow those procedures. If they're including all of the prior continuity, Captain Tripp would have been there. Honestly, if they had made lip service, you just said it, the war was probably just several days long. If they had said, okay, the war is over, and the C-130s full of Jokers from Vietnam were just landing as the war was ending, that would have been fine. I'd have been like, okay, he really was out to help and just couldn't organize it fast enough. I'd give you that, but they didn't pay any service to this.
You're right. Paying a little bit of lip service to it would have been good.
And there are other original major characters who do get just lip service. They're literally mentioned for a sentence in the book. I guess you could say my final complaint. It's the tone of the series. The original 12 books are absolutely rated R. Very possibly hard R because there's lots of sexual content in them as well. The newest round of books, even going so far back as Bane books, I would call a light PG. The first books were very graphically violent. That makes you go, ew. The characters were much darker. A character called Roulette, whose power was to kill you by having sex with you. And it was not just you had a heart attack and you died. Your crotch turned black and you died a horrible, horrible, painful death. It was disgusting.
And the sexual situations were very graphic.
Absolutely. When I said the jumpers were powered by buggery, I mean, there were essentially anal rapes. It was not pretty circumstances.
I wouldn't say R. I'd say NC-17, definitely.
Absolutely. And the new books and the new generation of characters is just, they're not bad. They're really well thought out. They're really wonderful characters, but they're light. When you compare somebody like Roulette to somebody like Bubbles, whose power is to make bubbles.
Bubbles that explode, but bubbles nonetheless.
In all truth, at the ending, she grew gradually more powerful. I think that's something that happened to really all the characters. Earth Witch just found out how powerful she really was. And at first, when you think that all Bubbles can do is just make bubbles, some of them are big, some of them are heavy. When you find out that she can make them dense enough to tear somebody's head off, okay, that's true. But you don't find that out until the last 30 pages of the book. It just looks like a character blowing bubbles.
I will agree that the rating has dropped. It is no longer an NC-17. I will, however, say that it's easily a PG-13, just in the fact that they do deal with some adult issues. They do have characters that have homosexual relationships. They do describe nudity. It's not anywhere near the graphic detail that the previous books had, but it is there. There is profanity used. Hard Hat by himself earns a PG-13 for this thing, if not rated R.
My only lention of this would be, I guess it depends on each author. Since they each write their own story, some of them are writing at a light PG, and others, I would give you, they are writing at more of a PG-13. There are probably enough swear words in a hardhead story that the swear words alone could garnish a rated R, even if there were no sexual or violent situations in it.
So again, this isn't necessarily something that I could recommend you hand to your 9-year-old to read. But I wouldn't have a problem in a 15, 16-year-old reading it, because they've probably read as bad, if not worse, before. To hand any of the first 12 to anybody under the age of 18, I'd be blushing.
Not that I believe in any sort of censorship of any type, but if that violence, if that sexual situations offend you, you will be offended. If it's something you want to keep from your children, then the first 12 books you want to keep from your children. I certainly read them before I was 18. I'd say shocked more than offended. Some of the stuff I read in there, I was like, whoa. And, you know, and you read about Roulette having sex with people and their members falling off. I just wanted to cry. I felt very sorry for them, even though they were bad people.
You weren't much younger than 18.
No, it's 17 and 18 when I read the first series.
There is one more point of review for this book, and it comes at the very end. The Aces, who have joined forces in Egypt to help the living gods, are called before the United Nations to form a super team. This, in and of itself, is almost a historic event within the Wildcard series, because they almost never have super teams form. It is an extreme rarity. Yes, occasionally Aces will come together to fight a big bad guy like the Astronomer or Bloat or the Swarm, but it never goes beyond that initial team-up. It's just, okay, there's a great big threat, we have to face it, we fight it, we're done, sayonara. The only other hero group that has formed within the Wild Cards universe is back in the very beginning of the series during the 1940s and 50s, called the Four Aces. These four characters were brought together by Dr. Takian and served as government agents for several years until they were brought before McCarthy's witch hunt. This team ended up in disaster. Golden Boy ended up being known as the Judas Ace because he actually testified against his fellow aces. One of them was committed to an insane asylum. One of them ended up in the gutters as a drunk, ostracized by everyone. One of them ended up dead. This golden age of heroes ended up in disaster. Kind of gives a good reason why you don't want to form a super team in this universe.
The question is history going to repeat itself? This is the first book in a trilogy. So if you look at it in comic book terms like me, this would be a setup issue. Everything in this issue is actually a MacGuffin for what's coming in the next two issues.
Is the committee the next four aces? Are they going to end up in disaster, or are they going to end up succeeding where their predecessors failed? It does a great job of setting up for the next book, without really giving away anything that's going to be in the next book.
There's two on-ramps, I guess I would call them. I get that from Jasper Ford. In this story, there is a British Secret Service agent who, by the end of the book, you realize there's a lot more going on with this character than the book indicated. The second one, a little less obvious, is the UN Secretary General. And he's a character who's also a hidden ace. I don't think people know he's an ace. With the ability to predict the future. He's the one who creates the super team. He knows something that hasn't been said yet.
And even within that particular on-ramp, there's a lot of character issues involved. You have...
There's a whole love triangle between Kate and John Fortune and Drummer Boy.
You have Earth Witch coming into her own as an actual hero. As we said, this does a good job of building up towards what's going to be happening next. And for all we know, some of the next books might actually deal with Vietnam and the fact that they might still not be on good speaking terms with the United Nations. What happens when this group of aces who just finished fighting to defend the Jokers are sent over to get this nation of Jokers under control? We don't know what the authors might have in store for us for the next two books. So, overall, how many pens in the pocket protector would you give this?
I think the writing was really tight. All of the stories were very well told, very well written. the composition, George R. R. Martin actually putting together the story that was written by several different people, making it one book which flows from cover to cover, was seamless and just done genius. And I would highly recommend it to any comic book fan or any science fiction fan and anyone who's read the previous Wildcard books. So that being said, and strictly in comparison to the other 18 books, I would only give this one 2 out of 4 pocket protectors. Still a recommendation, still a thumbs up, but just to let you know, there are other books out there that are much better.
This is yet again one of those situations where I enjoyed something a bit more than you did. I would actually give this 3 out of 4 pens in the pocket protector. I liked the development of the new characters. I thought everything was very tight, very well written, great editing by George R. R. Martin. I didn't have a problem with the amount of time that was spent in the States for a restart of the series. I thought it was just an excellent job. Okay, those of you who jumped ahead to avoid the spoilers, this is the point where you can start listening again. Upcoming TWRP projects. First of all, a recap of our last TWRP cast, the Oscar cast. I hang my head in deep shame.
As you should very often.
I only got 1 out of 7. This is the worst I've done in 2 decades of watching the Oscars. The only thing that I can say is I completely forgot about international law, which is anytime somebody from a foreign nation is nominated for one of these awards, they're probably going to get it. And that law was heavily enforced in this year's Oscars. Doug got 5 out of 7. Congratulations.
Hoo-ah!
And all I can say is we'll have to do it again next year so that I can redeem myself. During that Oscar cast, we also informed you about Joan Halloran being in the hospital. We are very happy to announce that she is back home again. This doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be rushing any Eras episodes out anytime soon, because now Matt is looking at having to move and is probably going to be looking for another job in the next month or so. So please, continue to bear with us. We will get more Eras out soon. We are continuing to write, we are continuing to record, we are continuing to do preliminary edits. We're just being very patient with our sound guy as he continues to get his life straightened out. Beyond that, our other shows are still in various stages of production. We'll let you know when they'll be hitting the web as soon as we have a firm date.
As always, we appreciate you listening to TWRPcast, and we would appreciate any feedback or comments that you have. Please email Jim at TWRPonline.net.
Thanks for listening, everybody. See you in about a month.
Boah.